It's on. Good afternoon, everyone. It's time to finish your plate. Welcome to FCC. My name is Florence de Changy. I'm a reporter with Le Monde, and I'm on the board of the FCC. It gives me great pleasure to welcome another outstanding speaker today, Mr. Timothy Birdson. And before I introduce him, let me just remind you of two coming up events. Actually, next week, we have a speaker about media and power in Singapore, Seeing Beyond. And then on the 10th, we have the former French Prime Minister, Dominique de Villepin, who will talk about the global debt crisis, what's at stake. Make sure also, please, that your phones are all turned off. Just a few words about our speaker. Mr. Birdson has lived in Hong Kong for 35 years. He currently lives between Hong Kong and Paris, he just told us. And he founded Crosby, the largest independent, freestanding, not the largest bank, the largest independent investment bank in the Far East. And it was the first to be licensed in China. It was also involved in most of the region and was the only foreign firm involved in the setting up of the Shanghai Stock Exchange. If my understanding is correct, he's going to tell us today that we don't need to worry about China's growth and becoming number one because China is stumbling on its way. I'm all the more interested to hear that, that I went to a fascinating lecture last week by several scholars from China were actually saying the opposite. So I'm sure we'll have plenty to discuss afterwards. His book, The Stumbling Giant, has been called the book of the week by the Time newspaper, and Global Times in Beijing also mentioned it, saying that it was a very useful one-stop shop for those looking for information. So without further ado, let me leave the floor to our speaker. Thank you very much, and welcome him, please.
Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. I should apologize that I can't see everybody, but I do hope everybody can hear. Can you hear in all the areas? Great. Thank you very much. Sometimes people introduce me as having lived here for 35 years, and this book is what I think as a result of that. And I think that's something I should comment on and say that this book took about 3.5 years to write. And if it encapsulated everything I thought 3.5 years ago, it would have been quite a different book. Because although I met a lot of people, I've had a lot of opportunities to learn and to engage with people at every level in China and in the Asian region. When I actually came to write a book, I changed some of my opinions on the things that I wrote about. And this book, therefore, is a combination of some of the thoughts that I've had over those years, but also simply doing rather more work, more intensely, in a short period of time recently. And on a number of subjects, I simply changed what I thought. The genesis of this book was that I was asked by Yale University in 2009 to give a lecture about where China was going to go in the 21st century. And afterwards, I was asked by the Yale University Press if I would expand that into a book. And that was a very interesting project and something I hadn't done before, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. But what I thought was interesting is not so much to talk about where China has come from, but where China will go from here. And I don't think that it's very helpful talk about the future through the extrapolation of straight lines, that the sort of Goldman Sachs model that by June 4th, 2027, America will be overtaken by China and this will happen and that will happen. Because even if that does take place, given the population differences of 4.5 Chinese to every one American, you can still have an awful lot of very poor people in China who in aggregate have a bigger economy than some rather richer people in America. It doesn't mean much. It doesn't tell us anything much about what the world is going to be like. So I set out to say, well, what is going to happen to China and how are we going to look at that? And I thought, this isn't something which is solely an economic issue. I looked at all the things that I thought drive where a country is going to go. I looked at education. I looked at language. The Chinese language is very different from the English language or the French language. I looked at culture. I looked at morality. I looked at education, demography, social conditions. I looked at all the things I thought were drivers of a country's future and tried to bring them together and to give an integrated picture of China through the 21st century, where's it going and why. And that, I'm afraid, is why the book is a little bit larger than might be desirable. Also, when you think that over the last 14 years, we're told that the most read subject in the print media or the internet media is the rise of China, it's amazing that I think there are probably fewer than 20 books in the English language on the future of China. And of those, 90% of them tell us that China will eventually overtake the United States and become the next superpower. My book will tell a different story. I will say that it's not likely to be the case. Obviously, the literature is quite wide. We've got books like The Coming Collapse of China. We've got books like When China Rules the World. I think I'm somewhere in the middle. But I'd rather take the view that the decisions in front of the Chinese leadership in the coming years are very tough, very difficult, and it's not clear that they're going to do the things that are necessary for China to grow at a rapid rate. What I do in the book is to talk about the challenges that I see coming at China, not necessarily visible now, but maybe coming later. What are they? How difficult are they? How should policymakers in China address them? Because I think if you're going to write about problems, you have a responsibility to talk about possible solutions. There are a lot of problems, but for me, the largest one is that of demography. And the demographic issue in China comes in four different forms. The first one is that the birth rate in China, the annual births in the 1970s, to 2010 have reduced by 40%. That's now coming through to the number of workers entering the workforce, quite naturally. This is a country which has built a very strong economic model on being the cheap place to manufacture goods for everybody in the world. In fact, for 12 years, wages didn't move at all in China. Now, wages in recent years have been moving up at a double-digit rate. China is becoming uncompetitive at what it was very good at doing in the past. And the debate is, what should it do next? Should it be a domestic consumption-led economy? Should it be an innovation-led economy? For me, there's very little choice. And I don't think the domestic consumer is going to bring out his wallet and support the economy, because there are too many uncertainties in his life every day, whether it's health, pensions, all sorts of issues. They're not going to spend until those issues are resolved, and they're not being dealt with at the moment. I think that what China will need to do is to find an innovation-driven model. And this has been government policy for over 15 years. The difficulty is that there's been very little sign of success in that transition. China tends to give quantitative targets. I think qualitative targets might be better. China looks at how much of GDP should be research and development spending. Maybe it ought to be 1.5% by this year, 2% by that year. And they tend to undershoot. And also, it's the wrong people spending the wrong money. Recently, there was a survey that 83% of all the high-tech exports from China are actually made by foreign companies, not by Chinese ones. There's very little sign of high technology in China. There are some patches of excellence, genome work, 3D printing, low-cost space technology, supercomputers. There's some wonderful patches of excellence, but overall, the commercial environment is dull and grey. They are not innovating, and this is something that's sorely needed. We can look at why that is. The focus has been on, should we have a lot more patents? Well, China's won a lot more patents, but they're often the lower quality utility patents, not the higher quality invention patents. And even if they're the invention patents, they're often not the ones that have commercial application. So we're not seeing China go out and succeed with innovation. And yet, it's not an ethnic problem. I mean, Chinese people in Silicon Valley are highly successful. There seem to be institutional constraints within the system, within mainland China. And I think they have to be really examined in a serious way. There's a culture of deference in the scientific community. The oldest scientist is automatically the best one. Young people's ideas are not particularly respected. There's a culture of plagiarism in China. I mean, all these things are problems. But that's the second demographic issue, or rather the first. But the second is the aging of China, where at the moment there are 100 million people in China who are over 65. By 2030, there are going to be 300 million over 65. And the trebling is not so much of a problem. It's what's happening to China's family. The typical Chinese family, people are living longer, but they're having fewer siblings, so they're having more dependents, parents, grandparents still alive. This is putting a huge pressure on, and it's reducing labor mobility, and people can't afford the same sorts of homes that they had several years ago. So their ability to just take in the elderly and put them at home is more reduced now. So the combination of a changing family structure and the vast increase in the elderly means that today there might be 1.5% of over 65s in institutional care in China. I think by 2030 that could be 50%. So we could be going from 1 million to 150 million. And the impact of that on the Chinese budget will be intense. And by the way, of course, China's budget, well, they may have the second largest economy in the world, but the budget is surprisingly small. I mean, last year, America, their budget was 40% of GDP. China's budget was 22% of GDP. So the ability to do things is more limited in China. And maybe in a few years' time, there'll be a debate as to whether we should have care homes for the elderly for 150 million people, or six new aircraft carriers. The third issue on the demographic front is the gender disparity. Because, of course, if people are going to decide to have fewer children, in a society with a deep rural heritage, a Confucian heritage, they often choose male children rather than female children. And they will then take steps to make sure that's the case. So over the last 20 years, there have been six boys born for every five girls. So we know that. So therefore, what we know is in the next two decades, we're going to be something approaching 50 million men who are not going to have a wife. And the problem will not be that one in six men, on average, will not get married. That won't be the problem. Women play, apparently, quite an important role in the decision to get married. And they, according to the sociologists, marry up. And this means they tend to marry men who are a little bit more affluent, a little bit more intelligent, even a little bit more better looking. So what we can take away from this is that maybe 40% of men who are poorer, stupider and uglier are not going to have a wife. And these men are going to be coming to the cities, they're going to be angry, and they're going to be inarticulate. And it's already showing up in the crime statistics in Chinese cities, and it's going to show up more, and it will eventually lead to incidents of social instability in China. The last demographic challenge that I see is the shape of the total population of the country. Because at the moment, China's population is still growing, but at a rather arthritic level. By the early 2020s, we're going to be looking at China being overtaken by the United States, by India, to become the largest, most populous country in the world. That has some economic impacts, more foreign direct investment flows going to India, maybe a little bit less to China, not a lot, but some economic impacts. By the late 2020s, every single demographic forecast will say that China is going to reach a population of approximately 1.4 billion people and then start to reduce. Because the fertility rates of families in China are about 1.45, 1.5. If you don't have 2.1, you don't have replacement rate. So we know pretty much what's going to happen to the Chinese population for several decades to come. The debate then becomes, well, how far does it reduce? How sharply? And the most benign forecast for China is that of the United Nations, because they're heavily influenced by what the member countries represent to them. So the United Nations says, well, the population of China by the end of this century will fall by one third to 950 million people. Every independent academic piece of research suggests a sharper fall. Anywhere down to two-thirds reduction in the population of China. That means we could be seeing a population of China of 500 million people by 2100, which is roughly what is the projected population of the United States. So we could be going from a world today where we have 4.5 Chinese for every one American to a world where we have 1 to 1. which has a strategic implication where scale doesn't matter so much. Then technology becomes the determining factor. But I think the largest thing that we can take from all this is that no country in history which has had a steeply and consistently falling population has been able to have at the same time a consistently sharply rising economic growth rate. So I would suggest by the 2030s, we're probably going to be saying, hasn't China done really well to score 2% growth this year? What that, I think, means is that all the other problems that China faces, whether it's cleaning up a mortally wounded environment, whether it's trying to create an education system that can foster innovation, whether it's trying to deal with a dysfunctional financial system, all of the various problems it's got, which are soluble problems, need to be addressed while China has the financial resources to address them. If it's left too late, there won't be the funding to deal with it. My concern is that Chinese policymakers have become somnolent. In the 80s and 90s, China was the fastest reforming country in the world. And from 2000 to now, China has reformed scarcely at all. So what I think we need is a sense of urgency, a sense of desire for radical reforms. And my worry is that there's not a great sense that that is on the agenda. And it's very interesting to know what the new leadership would like to do. Clearly, they've shown in various ways that they're interested in this subject, but then Wen and Hu made a very good analysis of the problems of China over the last period in power, but then didn't really tackle it. President Xi, Prime Minister Li, have made quite a good analysis of the issues now. The issue is, will they deal with it? Have they got the stomach? Because these reforms come with political prices to pay, and it's not clear that people are willing to pay those prices. So Chinese policymakers often give the sense that they feel that they're contemplating issues over centuries, and I would suggest they don't even have decades. The pressure's on, and I'm not sure they realize. So I think it's a really important time for China, and I'd like to see a greater sense of urgency. I haven't talked about foreign affairs, I haven't talked about military things, I haven't talked about cyber stuff, the environment. The book covers all sorts of areas that are pertinent to China's future, and I'm very happy to deal with all of them in the questions, but maybe I should stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We even have a little bit more time for the questions then, and I'll invite you to start. Please ask one question at a time and introduce yourself before asking.
Okay. You mentioned cyber, and I guess cyber warfare has been a big concern lately in terms of variety of companies saying that they've been broken into and reports that many more have been. Do you see that as an area of further Chinese activity, or is there any sign of restraint as part of the sort of concerns about being, as some people call it, a responsible stakeholder in the world system?
Yeah. it's one of the areas where I changed my mind when I actually came to write the book. What I thought, I decided that I shouldn't think. I thought that it was going to be very obvious that what China does in the cyber world is so differentiated and so egregious that we can make comparisons with the rest of the world and say, China just goes too far. But the more I looked at it, the harder I found it to sustain that argument. I do think China is technically the leader in cyber capability. It's probably also the leader in the extent, the volume of its activity. But everybody spies on everybody if a government can afford at least one laptop. What I thought we could make a difference about is perhaps there's something China does that other people don't do. But if France spies on its European partners, if America spies on Brazil, I mean, it's very difficult to find the moral distinctions. I thought that perhaps the difference might be that when China broke into the Pentagon and took 10 terabytes of information out, they also broke down the internet system in the Pentagon. When they broke into the State Department, the emails collapsed for half a day. So could we say perhaps that spying's all right because everybody does it, but maybe sabotage is wrong? And then along comes Stuxnet. And then, all right, well, if America and Israel are going to go and attack another country who they've not declared a war on at all, and try and bring down their systems. And by the way, third-party countries are also damaged as well, not just Iran. We can't really say that sabotage differentiates China from anybody else. So what does differentiate China? It does more of it, but I don't think it does worse things than anybody else does. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's been quite difficult to find a Geneva Convention for the cyber world, in the same way that it's difficult to find a Geneva Convention for spying. So I changed my mind and I felt that actually everybody's doing this stuff and I'm not sure that anybody's worse than anybody else.
I'm Jeff Chen with Cadwallader. What do you think about the rule of law in China, the future of the rule of law? And if you think that it's not going to go very much further, then what kind of effect on the life and the economy of China going forward?
Well, there are two kinds of law in China. There's commercial law and there's the rest. Commercial law, in many ways, works quite well. The rest of it is totally interspliced with political involvement in legal decisions. And then you've got the second issue where China passes some of the best laws in the world on things like environment, food safety, all sorts of things. But there's not a chance of implementation. So it's not just law, it's the whole system of governance. And I differentiate governance from government. I don't think Chinese people are particularly interested in what form of government there is. They just want it to work. And they don't particularly want to die of asphyxiation or lead poisoning. I don't think they're particularly interested in whether they vote or not. I think the party has a chance to redeem itself. And in the 80s and 90s, it was able to make huge adaptations to its model, which pleased people enormously. They're now in danger of not pleasing people in a really bad way. if they could get it right, they could be there another 30, 40, 50 years. But I think the issue is how they motivate and manage the cadres from top to bottom. It's not just a local official problem in cities. Everybody to the top knows there are serious problems. If they can deal with those, the party could stay in power. If they fail to deal with them, there's going to be a problem for the regime.
Alan Hudson, Oxford University. My question is, do you think reforms in the Chinese education system, certainly at higher educational level, if they're happening, are sufficient to solve the problem you said about innovation and creativity? Negative example, in Oxford, we're constantly constrained by the inability of humanities and social science doctoral students to cope with the idea of critical thinking and problem solving. Positive example, I did a summer school in Beijing where that seemed to be the case. And a professor of CAS said that's because the changes have already happened. Have they happened, and would it be enough?
Well, the last president of Yale said to me that presidents of Chinese universities think that if they teach liberal arts, they've taught critical thinking. And that's obviously a problem. I think the Chinese educational system, unfortunately, is wrong from top to bottom. Because there is this bottleneck called the Gaokao, which people have to pass in order to get to university. And China has rather followed many democratic countries around the world. The politicians have done what all politicians do, which is to say to the public, we are going to make your children university graduates, because that's how politicians feel they're going to become popular. So, maybe a third of Chinese young become university graduates. Say in the 90s there were 600,000, now there are 7 million. That may partly explain why there's 45% graduate unemployment in Chinese universities. It may also be explained by the fact that over the last 8 years, every 3 days, China has had a new university. The idea of quantity rather than quality is a besetting problem for China. It might be a better solution to close half the universities and spend the money on the rest. But if you're going to focus people on one university examination to get to university, it's not helpful if that examination has so many questions and each one has only one answer, and you learn it. And if you don't remember it, you fail. They don't say, what's your idea about the color blue? They say, this is the question, give us the answer. And as a result, you get a certain sort of student at university, and as a result, you get a certain sort of graduate. And people like McKinsey will tell us that when they poll multinationals in China, their view is that 85% of Chinese university graduates have no prospect of working in any international context. That the system is flawed from top to bottom. So it needs a radical overhaul, and that's why there is no Chinese university in the top 100 in the world. Now, we've got this survey from the Times Educational Supplement that came out today, but the better one to look at is the one that the Chinese university, Shanghai Jiao Tong, does, which monitors all the universities in the world. It doesn't rate any Chinese university, including itself, in the top 100. And I think that's more honest and accurate. Something has to give. This is the second biggest economy. We need to close this gap. But it means a radical change in the form of education in China.
Yes, at the back, the lady standing.
Thank you. I'm the reporter from FinTV. I also learned that you are one of the most successful businessmen and also very successful investment banker here in Hong Kong. So my question will be more focused on economics. A lot of news says that Hong Kong is currently losing its competitiveness as China is getting stronger. Especially we learned that there is a free trade zone in Shanghai. So I wonder, what do you think of the competitiveness of Hong Kong, and what aspect do you think Hong Kong needs to improve its competitiveness? Thanks.
Well, that's not really the subject in my book, but I think that Shanghai has to do a lot of things to become a global financial center. The sort of place where a Brazilian would float his company and a German would buy shares. I mean, we're not there. We're nowhere near there. And at the moment, Shanghai is a backwater, and attempts are being made to bring it forward a bit. And it's all very good. We don't know how long it's going to take, but Shanghai is nowhere near being a global financial center by years and years and years. But every attempt they make is jolly good, and we should encourage it.
Yes, in front here on the left.
Hi, Jean-Christian Briand from the Consul General of Canada. Interested to hear your views on China's foreign policy. I guess the current standing of China and the future of China's foreign policy, and maybe in particular the Sino-US relationship.
Yeah, China has 20 neighbors by land and sea, and I think it is in some degree of disagreement with about 14 of them. That's unfortunate. It's either about bits of land, or it's about water, or it's about... generally, it's about things China wants from them. And I think that makes China the anti-status quo power. And that makes it perhaps a worry to neighbors. It's not neighbors wanting things from China, apart from peacefulness. So I think China needs to ask itself, how do we want to look to the world? How do we want to appear? How do we want to present ourselves? And I don't think that debate has yet been properly had in China, and it needs to be had. And it could start with the press releases from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. We sternly, we severely, we demand. Perhaps some of this language could be looked at. Maybe there's a different way of formulating it. I think that as one rises as a power, it's good to just look at oneself from time to time and just say, what impression do we give to the rest of the world? Smaller places, unimportant places, what do they think about us? And I don't think those questions have been asked sufficiently. A lot of the focus in the press has been about rocky islands in East Asia. But I think that one of the most interesting things that China's engaged on at the moment is, understandably, because North China is the biggest piece of water-short land in the world, partly because they have drained and abused and overused their water resources. There's been a realization that they have military control of the Tibetan Plateau, where seven of the world's biggest rivers arise. And they've decided to divert some of that water across China. But of course, anybody who relies on those rivers is deeply nervous, whether that's India, Bangladesh, Russia, Kazakhstan, Vietnam. So many of the neighbors are deeply concerned about what China is going to do with water. And China's strategy has been not particularly to engage in dialogue. I think this is something China has to rethink about. Maybe dialogue is good. Maybe unilateralism is not good. Also, when you consider that the largest use of water in China is agriculture, which uses 70% of the water, and 55% of the water in agriculture is lost before it gets to the point of use, maybe one could spend more time on conservation rather than on diversion. And that would affect foreign policy issues. So I think there are a lot of points one could make. And I think China will gradually, over time, think about how it's perceived in the world and how it should converse with the world. I find it extraordinary what the United States does to China, flying planes over what they regard as their exclusion zones, sending warships along their coastline. I think America's attitude to China is very provocative. What they did with the, the Milky Way ship in Saudi Arabia, having it forcibly boarded in a Saudi Arabian port because they thought some gas was going to Iran. I mean, all this sort of stuff is quite confrontational. It's not the sort of behavior that leads to a good relationship. And then China's behavior to Japan is equally difficult. I mean, now China has overtaken Russia in the number of scrambles that it causes the Japanese Air Force through air incursions every year. I think it was 306 last year. Just flying over Japanese airspace, causing the Air Force to come up, sending ships across the borders. I think they all behave badly. And what are they trying to achieve? What's the goal? Is it to show you're a big power, or is it to try and win something? I think that both America and China could just step back and re-examine the way they conduct their policies.
So we may have time for one more question.
Good afternoon. My name is Dean White from the Australian Association in Hong Kong, and I'd like to just get your comments on, based on your research on corruption in China, with the recent Bo Jilai case spotlighted the corruption in China. So, two-part question: how corrupt do you believe China to be in the corporate world? And secondly, with the perceived crackdown of corruption from the current administration, how do you see business moving forward in China?
One of the things we always have to be careful about when we talk about China is context and proportion. If China has 1.3 billion people, it's going to have a lot of everything. So if somebody says, isn't there a lot of corruption in China? The answer is yes. Aren't there a lot of violin players in China? Yes. It means nothing. Is it disproportionate to the scale of China? Then it's important. I think the best objective survey of corruption around the world is Transparency International in Frankfurt. And their survey puts China in the top half of countries, not the bottom half. The bottom half is Nigeria, India, Indonesia, Pakistan, Russia. China's in the top half with the bottom half of the European Union and Brazil. Okay. Now, they still get marks like 65% corrupt. But I think what this tells us is the problem isn't China, the problem is the world. The world is corrupt. There are very few Swedens around. If you ask Chinese people, they'll often say corruption is their biggest issue. And it probably is. It is a big issue in China. What are these people doing about it? Well, in the last 14 years, three members of the Politburo have gone down for what was called corruption. I would still say that that was not taking it particularly seriously. And often the senior people who go down, it's generally felt, have not gone down because they were corrupt, but because they lost out in a party struggle. So are people being brought down actually because they're corrupt? That's the question we need to ask. I think Beaujolais is a very good example. I don't think he was brought down because he was corrupt. I think he was brought down because he was politically not somebody who was required. So we can't judge from the senior casualties what's really happening on the corruption front. There are tens of millions of officials, and there are several thousand people who are arrested and charged every year with corruption. That's skirting the surface. We need a more surgical approach, and I think there is a real systemic problem in China with confronting the complete management of the party and saying, the way we have been cannot be sustained, we must surgically change it. And I'm not sure whether there is the courage at the top to do this. And secondly, if there is, I'm not sure that there is the ability to carry it through. That's my concern.
Well, talking of corruption, we should give a gift, as we do, to our speakers. And because it's just past two and we try and keep our deadlines, I thank you all for coming, and we'll see you very soon. Thank you. And thank you to our speakers. And it's live.
It's not a paperweight.
I know, it's not even.